Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And Ian, our good martini, we should say at the outset, is not actually good, but it's good that it's being exposed. And it's right. Video number two from the Center for Medical Progress. And they're the ones, of course, who last week showed the video of Dr. Deborah Nucatola, who was very casually sipping her wine and eating her salad and talking about how she crushed above and below the torso so she could successfully harvest intact organs. It shocked the conscience. I think we're up to, what, seven states and three congressional committees. They're investigating now whether Planned Parenthood is actually doing for-profit sales of body parts of aborted children. The second video, which was released today, also by the Center for Medical Progress, features Dr. Mary Gatter, and the group says at the time of this video, she was the president of Planned Parenthood's Medical Directors Council. And as usual, it's a little bit hard to hear exactly what's being said here, but in this first clip, she and the actor representing a buyer of fetal parts are talking about the right price.
What would work for you? Don't lowball it. Okay. Tell me what you
really... $75 a specimen.
$75 a specimen. And then later on, Dr. Gatter talks about how she will have to check to see if that's the right price for specimens going to this alleged group.
It's been years since I've talked about compensation, so let me just figure out what others are getting. And if this is in the ballpark, then that's fine. If it's still low, then we can talk about it.
You would.
I want a Lamborghini. I said I want a Lamborghini.
Said she wants a Lamborghini, Ian, and it's just so sick to watch this conversation, but we're getting drip here that's going to make life very uneasy for folks at Planned Parenthood, because there seems to be more and more evidence that they are either very close or flagrantly over the line here when it comes to violating federal law.
There's been a question about what the first video revealed in terms of compensation, because that's the question in the actual statute, is whether it affects valuable compensation. The question of the details of the law here is important, but not necessarily the main thing. What you see here is this woman saying $75 for a, quote, specimen. And then when the actors say, oh, that's low ball, she'll happily say, oh, yeah, okay, I'll happily go up on that. The money's not the thing, but, you know, if you want to give me more, I wouldn't be opposed to that. She says at one point that there has to be enough money to make it worth it, which is a really grotesque sort of way to think about it. There's a second part that I don't think is getting quite as much attention, but is very, very important here, and I think has larger ramifications. And that's at one point she says she would be more than willing to talk to their surgeon about modifying the way the abortion is conducted to make sure that they can get the body parts intact. And she says, the reason this is something of a concern is because we tell the women who come in and we sign a contract that says we're not treating them any differently because they've agreed to donate the remains of the baby. But she says, we do that, and it's not that big of a deal. I'm sure the women wouldn't care if we told them, but, you know, you should know, which is just an extraordinary admission. It accords well with what we saw last week when Nucatola was saying they basically conduct an illegal partial birth abortion to make sure that they can get the body parts intact. But what you have here is this doctor saying, not only do we do it differently, we deceive the women who come in. It's an astonishing admission. And of course, it's all of a piece. You know, it's absolutely, it should come as no surprise to anyone that the group of people willing to kill children and then traffic in their body parts is not going to be all that concerned about slight violations of their contract obligations. But this is exactly the type of stuff that leads to a Gosnell, leads to the types of abortionists who have just extremely perverse incentives, not just to do the horrible things that they're doing, but to endanger women in the process. Everyone should be outraged at that, whether you're pro-life or not. Everyone should be able to say that that's just appalling. So finally, what you have ultimately is this. I wrote about this last week. My point was basically there's no way that you can reconcile the wholesale industry of abortion with foundational principles of right to life. And it's not a rule of law question. Ultimately, it's a question of conscience. And I think that Lamborghini line is going to be the one that sticks with people, because here you have another woman over another drink saying, oh, you know, isn't this hilarious, this joke I'm making about trafficking in human body parts? Even people who might be sympathetic to the abortion movement, who might think that these are clumps of cells, et cetera, are likely to be very disturbed by that sort of blasé attitude, that joking attitude about what's going on.
Ugh. And that's the good martini, folks. But good that this is being exposed. We'll see if something can come from this. But on to the bad martini now, and this is courtesy of Fox News. The Obama administration wants to keep people collecting Social Security benefits from owning guns if it is determined they are unable to manage their own affairs. This report originally came from the Los Angeles Times. The Fox story reads, "The push, which could potentially affect millions whose monthly disability payments are handled by others, is intended to bring the Social Security Administration in line with laws that prevent gun sales to felons, drug addicts, immigrants in the United States illegally, and others," according to the paper. "The language of federal gun laws restricts ownership to people who are unable to manage their own affairs due to, quote, marked subnormal intelligence or mental illness, incompetency, condition, or disease, which could potentially affect a large group within Social Security." So, Ian, obviously, for those who have watched the gun agenda of the Obama administration, it looks like they're trying to get a foot in the door that a lot of people fear could go a lot farther if they get away with this.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's just a horribly broad, sweeping effort to do something which is reasonable, which is to keep guns out of the hands of those who are mentally unstable. But this is a nonsense. This is an absurd way to go about determining that. You look at something like the SAFE Act, which is on the books in New York, which is an even sort of broader way of going about the same process. There, someone who has received prescription medication for depression can go on exactly this type of list and be prohibited from owning a firearm. The central issue here should be, what is the default position of the federal government toward Second Amendment rights? My colleague Charles Cook is sort of our go-to person on this, and he's been asked multiple times about the question of, say, firearm insurance. Why don't you have to have insurance for a gun the way you have insurance for a vehicle, something like that? And the obvious answer is, because owning a vehicle is not in the constitutional right, while owning a firearm is. The default position of the government should always be to protect the personal liberty, and then the burden of proof should be on the government to in any way curtail or limit that right. What this effort, the SAFE Act, all of these sorts of initiatives do is reverse that burden and put the onus on the individual to prove themselves competent to own a firearm. And that's entirely backwards from the way the framers set up the system.
On to the crazy martini now, Ian. And for that, we go to the Netroots Nation, which should be a bountiful place to find some crazy martinis. It did not disappoint. Earlier this week, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley was among the Democratic presidential hopefuls trying to appeal to the folks who actually go to this sort of thing. And one of the issues that came up, of course, was Black Lives Matter. And O'Malley set out on a series of comments that I think he was really sure was going to endear him to the crowd. They most certainly did not.
Some of the most important things that we accomplish in life, you know, requires persistence. We did not repeal the death penalty in Maryland the first time we tried or the second time, but we repealed it the third time we tried. Every life matters, and that is why this issue is so important. Black lives matter, white lives matter, all lives matter. Black lives matter, white lives matter. All lives matter.
Obviously, the base not too happy with that one, Ian. So Martin O'Malley deciding he needs to do some damage control for apparently thinking so foolishly that all life ought to be protected, goes on the L. Joy Williams show, and I kid you not, her show is called The Day in Blackness. And so she says, do you understand why people are upset? Because of it's perceived that black lives are less important to law enforcement and that sort of thing. So here's Martin O'Malley trying to dig himself out of a hole that it's hard to believe he was actually in.
I believe what I first said was that black lives matter before those other two phrases. And when I said those other two phrases, I meant no disrespect to the point, which I understand, and that Black Lives Matter is making. That was a mistake on my part, and I meant no disrespect. And I did not mean to be insensitive in any way or to communicate that I did not understand the tremendous passion, commitment, and feeling and depth of feeling that all of us should be attaching to this issue.
Multiple choice for you, Ian. I don't know which one's crazier, getting booed for saying that all lives matter or apologizing for saying that all lives matter.
This is a really extraordinary state of affairs that we've come to. And I'm of two minds. It's sort of delicious if you're on the right watching this happen, because this is just a terrible political situation for Democratic candidates. They have this element of the left-wing electorate that is just rabid on this subject. Set aside the question of the merits of what the Black Lives protesters are arguing. This is a true sort of radicalism, far, far more than anything that you have on the right. These are people who write op-eds talking about, you know, the need for uprisings and revolutions and all of this stuff. And even when you have a candidate like O'Malley, like Sanders, who by any estimation would be the most sympathetic of anyone who's going to be running to these issues, three words are enough to get him booed off the stage. It's an extraordinary moment, and for anyone watching on the right just has to enjoy how some elements of the left are eating other elements of the left, and that fracture could be advantageous when the time comes for Republicans at the ballot box. So that's the upside, which is a somewhat cynical political upside. The downside is this is an element of our culture, of American culture. It's a phenomenon of the left, but we all have to deal with it. And the fact that you have such a vocal segment of the population that in so many circumstances demonstrates a manifest hostility to basic expressions of decency when, you know, someone comes out and says, oh, all lives matter. Of course that's true, but the crowd losing control of itself is something that should be just extraordinarily off-putting to all of us. And it's something that we're going to have to deal with as a nation, as you know, communities. It's not something, unfortunately, that is just going to be a phenomenon of the left that doesn't touch the rest of us. So that's the downside, and that's the worrying part here.
Ian, not only did the O'Malley session devolve into chaos, the Bernie Sanders session devolved into chaos. Hillary Clinton, who of course is never going to put herself into such an unscripted situation, was not there. So that might have been a fairly smart move on her part in this case. But can you just imagine how much fun that would have been?
Oh, absolutely. Look, all of this is going to come out in the general election too. And again, to go back to the political angle here, it's not going to matter that much for a Republican because, look, all of these folks are dyed-in-the-wool left-wing voters. Anyways, the question is, are they going to turn out or not? The real danger is for a left-wing politician who really needs to court these voters without alienating all the rest of voters who are less strident on these issues, who think, gosh, this is a candidate who is afraid to say all lives matter. That's going to be the issue that hurts them.
Yes, and going back to our first martini, that might be a good phrase for the Republican nominee to use once we know the full scope of the Planned Parenthood story. Ian, always great to have you with us, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right, sounds good.
Ian Tuttle of National Review, and for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.